A Small Union by Peter Tinniswood, with Bernard Hill and Liz Golding. When I was a young man, well, younger than I am now, when I was a younger man, I had what we call in the trade burning ambitions. I believed in rectitude. I believed in probity. I didn't quite know what it all meant until the Union sent me on this weekend course to Douglas, which, as you probably know, is in the Isle of Man. It was a seminar called Probity and Rectitude in the Field of Industrial Relations. I only went because our district convener, Walter Knowsley, fell foul of a bout of pneumonia. That's how I met my wife.
He was very wiry, I remember, when I first met him. He was taut and slim. He was like a fuse wire. He talked very earnestly and very slowly, which was curious for such a wiry man. He licked his lips a lot and drank a great deal of beer. He said he had burning ambitions to succeed in the movement. He wanted to go to the very top. He said he had an overwhelming, all-consuming crusade to help the underprivileged, and would I like to go to bed with him? I said yes, and we did.
It was an excellent experience. Most satisfactory. And I discovered there and then one of the greatest virtues of the trade union movement. Its bedding activities. She was excellent in every way, was Lorna. If she'd been on the blonde side and a wee bit small around the hips, she could have looked like one of the Beverly sisters. As it transpired, however, she had a tendency toward dumpiness and she was dark. She was luscious. And she was also a delegate from one of our more militant white-collar unions.
He reminded me of a younger version of Norman Wisdom. He was quite small, really. He was, as we say in the movement, very full of himself in bed.
When I got home from Douglas, Isle of Man, we docked incidentally at Heysham, Lancashire. I discovered that Walter Knowsley had succumbed to his bout of pneumonia. According to the medicos, there had been complications. And so, to my intense personal satisfaction, the membership appointed me in his stead. My first step up the ladder. I was someone in the movement. Rectitude. Probity. Bollocks. That was a good few years ago. Since then I seem to have developed a boozer's belly and drooping nipples. I'm sitting on the canal bank. I'm no longer in the union. My wife has left me. If I were a poet, I'd write rhymes and rhythms of despair. If I were a sensitive man, I'd squash my head to pulp between those two lock gates yonder. They were both small unions. The marriage to my wife, the organisation, of which in the fullness of time I had the honour of becoming General Secretary. As a trade union official, I dealt with the problems, the multifarious problems, I might say, of skilled operatives in the cotton trade. As a married man, I dealt with the problems of man management and demarcation disputes. What were my successes, I ask myself now.
You're totally obsessed with your work, Stanley.
I know.
You've no time for me, no time at all.
Oh, yes, I am.
Well, show it then. Show it to me.
I'm showing it by discussing my work with you. Good grief, Lorna. We've got the big guns of the AGWU breathing down our necks again. They want to take us over. They want to destroy us, obliterate us. As I said to my executive committee, we are but minnows, desperately fighting to save ourselves from the jagged teeth of the bite of the pike.
Well, I bet that went down like a bomb.
Well, naturally, Lorna, naturally. There was spontaneous applause. Do you know what I could just fancy now?
Tell me, Stanley.
I could just fancy a Lancashire hot pot like my mother used to make. Beef, scrag end of lamb, and the juices running over the side of your plate. There used to be a wharf here on the canal bank. Well, there still is, if the truth be known, but now it's deserted. It's broken backed, and the water's full of sodden mattresses and buckled prams. That was in the days of my prime, when I believed in rectitude and probity, and the union was flourishing and full of rampant women, all ripe for bedding. This canal used to be full of narrow boats. It was heaving with them. There used to be a chimney prodding at the guts of the sky, and you could hear the machinery whirring and throbbing. As General Secretary of the Union, I'd walk through the mill, and I'd be in my pomp, and I'd shout above the roar, "Now then, Nathan, me old lad, have you sorted yourself out at foot hospital then?" Or I'd whisper into the ear of one of those luscious, wet-tongued lasses with their chapped, willing hands, "Same time, Sarah, same time. I'll be waiting." I knew everyone in the Union then, and they all knew me. All gone now. The mill, the lads, the lasses, my members. It's a damp, deserted day, and I'm damp and deserted too. My dad was a grave digger. He was a small man with big hands and spoke slowly. He wasn't unionized. That's what instigated my burning ambitions to succeed in the movement, I suppose. As it must have been that. He drank, did my dad. He was a drinking man. He beat my mother when he came home from the non-political club on Saturday nights. He scorned all reading matter except for the Sporting Chronicle. Not like my wife. Not like her side of the family. She came from the county of Cheshire, and her parents took her to the opera and symphony concerts and celebrity lectures, and they sent her to a white-collar university. Oh, she was a real toff, was my wife.
Bollocks, Stanley. Rubbish.
We spent our first marital holiday at Colwyn Bay on the North Wales coast. It was the venue of the Union's annual conference. Well, we couldn't afford Andover, you see. It was too expensive in monetary terms. I liked Colwyn Bay, it suited my mood. The damp Welsh hills wheezed with catarrh. The damp Irish sea lolled and dawdled. I remember the oyster catchers piping. There was a 20-inch colour television in our bedroom, and Lorna watched a chamber concert of classical music on BBC Two on Sunday afternoon. I somehow knew, there and then, that I'd made a grave mistake in our union. 3 years later, the AGWU made its overtures. "You're a small union," they said. "You're not viable. Amalgamate with us," they said, "against the cutthroat market forces of a free enterprise economy."
It's a load of old rubbish, Stanley. Stand firm, don't be taken in. Rectitude, Stanley. Probity, my dear.
Our marital relationship had withered by then. Its veins stood out, purple and bruised. We were non-combatants in the battlefields of conjugality. It was the weekend of our annual conference in Bridlington, where we couldn't afford Scarborough. It was too expensive in monetary terms. I went out, alone at night. I walked on the beach. It was winter. It was cold. It was dark. I could sense the flat fish snuffling the shallows. I could sense the long, low silence to come. Next day, I addressed a full meeting of the membership of my executive committee. My speech went roughly thus. "Gentlemen, we are a small union. We are a weak union, both in membership and financial resources. We are weak in both clout and influence as regards our relationships with management. We are, gentlemen and comrades, blah, blah, blah." It was a bloody good speech, full of fire and compassion and concern, and not a word did they understand. Small minds. narrow minds, minds like bleak yards and drafty ginnels, and the delegate from Congleton stared at me with her husky brown eyes. That evening I met my wife in a pub. She was pregnant.
So what happened today, Stanley?
I put my proposals to my executive committee, Lorna. I put it to them straight. If you reject my plans, I said, we stay as we are. Weak, fossilized, shriveling day by day. No relevance, no clout, no influence, no strength. Seek a new partner, I said, and we have a new future.
Which union are you talking about, Stanley? Ours or yours?
A year later, at our annual conference at Grangeover Sands, Lancashire, after full, lengthy and exhaustive consultations, my union voted overwhelmingly to amalgamate with the AGWU. The delegate from Congleton congratulated me in person. Those husky brown eyes. The bedroom, overlooking the curve and sweep of Morecambe Bay. The curve and sweep of her thighs. How she swooned. How she sighed. When I first married Lorna, I used to play this little trick on her. Without her knowledge and her cognizance, I would record her voice on the pocket tape recorder my Finance and General Purposes Committee had authorised for my use in matters of correspondence, or the taking of notes during lengthy train journeys, or fraternal conferences on the continent of Europe. She'd go potty when I played them back to her.
Well, I had lunch with Barry today at this little Italian restaurant at the back of... Oh, God, Stanley, have you got that tape recorder on again? It's so childish, it's so irredeemably juvenile.
And there was that time she came back from the meeting in Fishguards, South Wales, and said...
Sir Barry said he wants me to go to Cuba with him on the delegation. The thing is, I've got to make sure Sally can get back from... Oh, Stanley, not again! Why don't you grow up?
I first met Barry 2 months after his return from Cuba. He wasn't at all suntanned. His forehead was the colour of a dried-out dishcloth. Lorna had come back as ripe as a nut. She was brown all over, and her skin was hot to the touch. Barry said Lorna had been absolutely invaluable in Cuba. She made a terrific impression on every single one of her fellow delegates, he said.
And we went to this squalid little nightclub place on the beach, and Barry and I were sharing a table with these ghastly comrades from East Germany, and this secret policeman with the gold teeth and the pistol came up and asked me to dance. Well, quite naturally, Barry intervened and... Oh, no, Stanley, you've not started that all over again.
Barry and I were fellow delegates at a weekend union conference in Ventnor, Isle of Wight. I was representing the AGWU, which, since our merger, had appointed me chief assistant in the forward planning department. Barry had a beard. It was a weak beard, on a weak chin. He wore a lime green leather jacket, with ammonia stains on the right sleeve. He offered his condolences on Lorna's latest miscarriage. We had a few beers and a plate of tongue sandwiches, and then I went to bed with a delegate from Stafford in the Potteries. It was excellent. How she swooned. How she sighed. Apart from the size of her nose, she looked remarkably like Sue Cook from Crime Watch.
Well then, Stanley, and how was Ventnor?
Not bad.
Your fellow delegates agreeable, were they?
Yes, excellent. Very passable.
And very beddable, too.
What? What did you say?
Come on, Stanley, you don't fool me, love. You never have.
I thought Barry was nice.
Oh, he is, Stanley. Very nice. Excellent.
We were living in a ground floor garden flat in Highgate at the time. After the amalgamation, I had been compelled to move down south. Lorna was delighted, of course. She'd hated the north. Well, people from the County of Cheshire always do.
Cheshire, nothing against Northerners as such, Stanley. It's just that it sounds warm and gentle about life, and it's clearing and devious. And... Oh, I see. You've got your machine on again. Very funny, Stanley. Ho, ho, ho!
I had to pay frequent visits to the North. It was most unpleasant. The lads and the lasses treated me with contempt. Mills closing. Factories closing. Redundancies. Foreclosures on mortgages and video machines, their eyes were resentful. They distrusted my suit. Their faces were sullen. They sneered at my briefcase. I was a traitor, a turncoat. I deserted them for the good life in London. What were my 7 pieces of silver? The delegate from Congleton spurned my advances. The canal turned its back on me and sighed. It was a relief to return to the ground floor garden flat in Highgate.
Stanley, I wasn't expecting you back today.
I know. I managed to sort things out sooner than I expected. I got the redundancy payments up by 20%. And
I'm
had
going
a word
out
with
this evening, you know.
Oh, yes?
Of course I am. I've got my own life to lead, you know.
Hmm. Where are you going?
To the Wigmore Hall, as a matter of fact, Stanley. It's a concert of chamber music by Haydn. You wouldn't want to come to that now, would you?
Suppose not. I'm not all that keen on Haydn, really.
After Mother died of her unexpected stroke, Father went to live with his widowed sister in Prestatyn in North Wales, a few miles up the coast from Colwyn Bay. It was a great burden to me, being an only son. Father couldn't cope. His widowed sister put an immediate stop to his drinking activities. She took him out every day in her Hillman Imp for afternoon tea. She bought him a suede trilby. She made him join a book club. She turned him into a reluctant devotee of garden centres. He just could not cope. "You never come and see me, son," he used to say. "Since you've been amalgamated and gone and lived in London, you've never had time for your old dad. You've never had time for nothing, have you?" One morning I told Lorna that I'd have to go to North Wales for the weekend to see him and pay him a visit.
"So, go and see him, Stanley. It's no skin off my nose. There's no need to make a deal about it."
I took the train from Euston, which in the halcyon days of steam had been the main terminal of the London and North Western Railway. We were pulled by an electric loco. I took lunch in the dining car. Sitting opposite me was a lady reading the official magazine of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. Her hair was greying at the temples, but she wasn't old. She was about my age, and I'm not old. She had a gold charm bracelet that jangled when she turned the pages of her journal. She told me she was visiting her parents in Rhyl. Her husband, who hailed from the home counties where they now lived, had a position in the city and refused point blank to come with her. She had blue eyes and a sad smile. On the following Saturday evening, she borrowed her father's office in Cambridge and we went for surreptitious drinks to a pub at Ross-on-Sea. She said she had never met a trade union official before. She was intrigued. She was called Barbara, and she had studied geography at Reading University. We kissed in the car in the cul-de-sac outside my father's house, and I took her address and telephone number. She was ex-directory. As I tossed and turned on the Z-bed that night, I remembered her soft, low voice and the rasp of her stockings and the sparkle of her blue eyes as I told her of the machinations and perfidies in the movement. I didn't tell her of the bedding activities, though. She told me her husband was a church warden. When I got back to the ground floor garden flat in Highgate on the Monday evening, there was no sign of Lorna. I had baked beans on toast and 3 cans of lager. Lorna didn't turn up till the following morning.
Oh, you're back already, are you?
Yes.
How did it go?
Not bad.
How was your father?
Not bad. Where have you been?
Out.
Is that all?
That's right, Stanley. That's all.
That was a few years ago, when I was younger than I am now. I'm on the canal bank. I might go for a drink or two. Father's waiting for his dinner. When his widowed sister took a tumble in the shopping precinct and subsequently died, he discovered that she'd left him the detached house in the cul-de-sac in Prestatyn, North Wales. He sold it and bought a terraced house back here in the north, in our hometown, hunched up close in the flanks of the Pennines. I was grateful to move in with him. It gave me a roof over my head. He's 87, is my father, and he still eats like a horse. Tripe in batter, cow heel stew. In the evening, he has the television going full blast. It drives me mad. A year after our tryst in the pub at Ross-on-Sea, Barbara and I took a holiday together on the west coast of Scotland. She told her husband, the church warden, that she was going on a field studies course in ornithology. Black guillemots, merganser, scoter, malt whiskey, bannocks, corncrake and eider. By then, Lorna and I had parted. I remember how it happened.
I'm leaving you, Stanley.
I see. Another man, is it?
Yes.
Barry?
Barry? Good God, no. That pathetic little squirt with his damn teeth and his tartan shirts and his cigarette cards. Barry? What the hell do you think I am?
So, who is this other man?
You.
Me?
Yes, Stanley, you. You're the other man who's destroyed our marriage. When I first met you, you were a man of principle. You were a man of strength, a man of probity and rectitude. You cared for your people, you fought for them, you grieved for them, you laughed with them and you wept with them. You bedded them, and I loved you. I admired you. I was proud of you. And then you sold out. You gave in. You capitulated. Amalgamation. Castration, my dear. Castration. Why did you do it, Stanley? Why?
We set out for the west coast of Scotland, Barbara and I, from Euston Station. We were pulled all the way by electric loco. We stayed in a modest private hotel with its own garaging, which of course we didn't require. We had separate bedrooms, each with its own tea-making facilities. Grey seals with fat, silky bellies and husky brown eyes. How they swooned. How they sighed. We did not have relations, Barbara and I. I did not bed her. We kissed, of course. We held hands. I liked her sensible skirts and her sensible shoes. I liked the way she took the tops off her eggs and the way she put her fist to her mouth and gasped when the gannets plunged, helter-skelter and stiff, into the sea. I liked her taste in music.
When all the skies are grey and it's a rainy day, think of the birds in spring.
Later in the year, I took her to the TUC annual conference in Blackpool, Lancashire. I was part of the delegation of the AGWU. I travelled up first class, special rate, from Euston. Barbara travelled independently. We stayed in a modest seafront hotel with a lift. She loved Blackpool, did Barbara. She loved the trams. She loved the piers. She loved the bluster and the heavy feet and the smokers' coughs. And the slurping and the snorting and the composite motions. How we laughed over the composite motions. I resolved, there and then, to marry her. We would live in a small house next to and almost adjoining the common at Wimbledon. We would take walking holidays in the Austrian Alps. We would go to concerts of light classical music at the Fairfield Hall, Croydon. We would take out a joint charge card at Marks and Spencer's and go late-night shopping once a week at Kingston-upon-Thames. She could join the Open University and resume her studies. We'd never be short of candles and nightlights in case of power cuts in the winter. When I thought of our future together, how I swooned and how I sighed. And then I met her in the bar at the Hydro.
Hello, Stanley.
Lorna.
Don't look so surprised, Stanley. I've just as much right to be here as you.
You've changed the colour of your hair.
I know. Do you like it?
Yes. It makes quite a change.
And how are things going with you, Stanley?
Excellent. And you?
Excellent. I've someone with me who's anxious to meet you.
Who?
I'll bring her over.
She did. It was the delegate from Congleton. She'd aged. She'd got jowls. She smiled at me and took me by the hand. "This way, Stanley," she said. I felt the smirk of Lorna rippling down the rills of my spine. I couldn't stop myself. I knew it was wrong, but I had to do it. I had to give way and let her lead me to her bedroom. That delegate from Congleton. The curve and sweep of her thighs. Her moans, her cries. She shut the door of the bedroom. She locked it. And then she said, "Got you, you bastard! Got you!" What, I said? I'd been waiting for this moment for years and years and years. I know, my dear Stanley, why you sold us out. Well, what, I said? What? She spared no details. Ledgers, statements, tampered books, my new account in the trustee's savings bank.
Oh, pretty high again, Stanley. It's wonderful. Superb. How on earth did you manage to afford it? How on earth did... Stanley, switch that bloody thing off.
Oh, she'd been diligent, had that delegate from Congleton. For year after year, she'd ferreted and probed.
A triumph stag, Stanley. How did you manage to afford it? How on earth did you... No, Stanley. Don't turn it off. Let's listen to ourselves as we celebrate our love.
The delegate from Congleton was swift and to the point. Resign and nothing would be revealed. Stay on I resigned. There and then, I walked out. I took the train back to London, second class. I did not see Barbara again. I left her in the modest hotel in Blackpool. I used to be a man of rectitude. I used to be a man of probity. So who cares? Brothers, comrades, ladies and gentlemen. It's growing cold here on the canal bank. I'd better get back to father. I hate unions. I hate unions of every shape and variety. I loathe them. When father dies, I shall be on my own. The last union of all, dead and buried. Hurry up, father. Die and I shall be free. Lorna, Barbara, the delegate from Congleton, lovely ladies from the movement with your soft ears and your willing hands, the composite motion is withdrawn at source. Hello. Now there's a lovely lady looking at me from the lock gate yonder. I wonder if she's unionized.
Bernard Hill was Stanley and Liz Golding Lorna in A Small Union by Peter Tinniswood. The play was directed by Peter Kavanagh.